start with, how do we actually know each other?
Is it been more than 30 years?
Oh, maybe. My God. 3 decades.
Yeah. Almost. I think it's close to 30 years. So, yeah, I mean, we know each other since school, like, and since class one or class two or something like this, right?
I think we know each other from class one.
I remember one, you know, how our sort of like how we hit it off or how our friendship started as well. I remember in class, I guess it was class one. I used to go by bus. And at that time, I don't know whether you used to go by bus or not. I think your parents used to pick you up or something like this. But yeah. I used to go by bus. I know that. And I had a massive sort of like one time I had a massive stomach ache or something. I wasn't even able to walk properly. And it was you who sort of like picked me up and helped me to my bus. And then that was the start of, you know, us talking and sort of having that that friendship. So that was something that I really, really remembered, like how we started talking.
Oh my God.
And it started with your kindness. So once again, thank you
I'm basically a people pleaser. That habit has not gone away yet.
Not a bad quality to have.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's such a beautiful memory. And you were actually my first friend who told me and taught me about so many things.
Not
and introduced me to Batman and Superman.
Yes. I remember you say that.
I remember I used to come over to your place and you were the only person I knew who had a VCR and yeah. You would play Superman movies and Batman movies. And I was like,
yeah, I remember. And now my son is a huge Batman fan as well. So,
that
thing gets passed on.
For the audience listening to this podcast, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do. Give us a quick version of your sort of journey.
Yeah. My name is Shwetank Dixit. And I am, well, it's very difficult to describe now. I am now a founder of a stealth startup. But before this, I was VP of core technology at a company called IO, mostly famous for Adblock Plus. Before that, I was head of R&D at a small company called Barrier Break, which makes technology for people with disabilities. And before this, I spent about 9 years at Opera, the browser, in the developer relations team, and later on became PM of the extensions team as well. I, in general, like to focus on product management, helping product people become better. But in general, it's about helping people in their careers. And thinking and providing perspectives that can sort of like help them out in their day to day. So that's what I'm trying to focus on now.
I want to actually do a little bit of a double click, and because you didn't cover this, but I remember the first time we sort of hung out outside of school and we had sort of grown up and finished college and stuff. And I was trying to like figure my life out, and you were already working for this company called Opera. Tell the audience a little bit about how you got your first job and how you got hired by Opera and becoming like this web evangelist. And what does that mean? And what does that look like? And how did that happen?
When I was in college, I was already super fascinated by the web. And I was essentially just looking for a way to contribute to the web and work in a web company. I was initially thinking of working in a company which would be making websites. But what I found out was that Opera, the browser, was also having an office in Chandigarh. And that was something which was really fascinating. I was like, okay. And during the course of me being a college student, I attended a lot of, you know, industry events, which was sort of unusual for college students at that time, but I was really passionate about the web, so I did. And over there, I got to know a few people from the Opera team at that time as well. So they sort of like knew who I was. And then when it came to, you know, me graduating and me thinking about, okay, what my next step would be, I sort of, you know, hit them up and say, hey, you know, is there any opening over there? And I was thinking of maybe an engineer sort of like opening. And they sort of like said, yes, we would love to have any, you know, all kinds of smart people. There's no opening right now for engineers, but, you know, we're looking for smart people. So if you want to apply, you know, just do that and we'll see, we'll figure out a position. So I said, okay, let me just take my time. I did that. And over the next couple of weeks, I found an opening which sort of fascinated me quite a lot. It was called Web Evangelist. And that appealed to me a little bit more because it wasn't just standard engineering. It was about going to different conferences and talking to other developers about what's happening in the browser and how they can use that in their websites and stuff like that. And who, as a 22-year-old or 23-year-old, you know, who doesn't want to travel all across the country and the world and talk to other developers and stuff like this and working on a browser. So I applied for that position. And it was a sort of a very unusual application procedure as well, because that application procedure had essentially 18 questions that I had to answer. I had a bunch of different, you know, we covered this RFC, you know, what would be the best, you know, RFCs for a browser, all those kind of things. But at the same time, there was also one in, you know, the last question was essentially write your 19th question yourself and answer it yourself. So write your own question and answer it yourself.
I'm so curious what you wrote on that question and what answer you gave.
Yeah, it was essentially trying to take a look at the role. Like it was, you know, the web evangelist position was such that you needed to connect with developers. You know, it's a position open in India, so you would talk to mostly Indian developers. So my question, I don't remember exactly what I wrote, but it was something along the lines of how would you further the cause of whatever you're doing right now for the Indian market? And then I sort of like expanded upon that. And it sort of, I guess, worked because they gave me another interview. I did that. And afterwards, they offered me that job. So that is something which I'm highly grateful for, that I took that chance. And also I'm highly grateful that a company like Opera was like, okay, we don't have a position open, but just apply and we'll figure it out. We just need smart people, which is a sort of something that I've tried to use in other companies as well, where even if we don't have an opening, we still encourage people to apply and we sort of like figure it out.
I mean, there's so many fantastic things that you've just said, and I want to sort of expand on some of those things. One is, I remember that, and I don't know what happened later in life, but early on when we were like very young, like in our school days, we weren't the brightest kids. We were sort of the, we were like the outliers, right? And then what happened between that point and you having like this foresight to start attending industry events when all of us were so busy trying to like chase girls or do stupid things? Like, how did that even happen for you?
You mentioned the fact that we weren't the brightest kids. I would challenge that a little bit. I think both of us were pretty bright. What I realized very early on, even at that time, was that, you know, we just didn't enjoy the structure of the current, at that point, the academic setting. And the stuff that was considered markers of success didn't really correlate with actual intelligence and actual, it was more of a, you know, the even right now, the current education system is more of a marker of you just doing rote learning, memorization, following procedures, all those kind of things, which a lot of people are, even if they're really bright or intelligent, they sometimes are just not cut out for that kind of thing. So you can sort of grit your teeth and get by, which I tried to do. It's just one of those things, right? It's not a measure of your creativity. It's not a measure of your empathy. It's not a measure of many other markers of success later on in life, right? Teamwork and all those kind of things. So that's one thing. And afterwards, even in the first 2 years of my college life, I remember, you know, I took a look at the 4 years of the curriculum, and I knew that these first 2 years is going to suck for me. All those kind of things, like you had to learn physics in a computer science class. Like, why would, and there are a bunch of these different things that I knew that I had no interest in, but I had to grit my teeth and get by. And the later 2 years were things that I was really interested in: databases, you know, networking theory, you know, operating systems, all those kind of things. And those are things that I just on my own time, since I was just interested, I just took a look. And one more thing, which was really, you know, maybe you can relate upon this, is that sometimes the teaching methodology, which was used back in the day, at least, wasn't really the best. So one of the great things that I really liked about the internet was that I could learn on my own pace. And if I was wrong, I wasn't punished for it, right? A lot of times, you know, in many schools, there's this lack of psychological safety. If the teacher asks you something and you don't have the answer, you're somehow going to get punished, right? Even if in an exam, like if you don't have the correct answer, you're not going to get the full marks. If I'm learning SQL and if I don't get the query right, it's just an error. I can look it up. I can improve. You know, there's no one penalizing me anyhow, right? So that really was a big, big help for me, because then I was like, okay, I can learn on my own pace. There's no penalty for being wrong. In fact, that's how you learn, right? You try things out. One thing doesn't work, but the other thing works, and you sort of like get better and better and better. So that's the thing which sort of like helped me level up in many of these things. And then the internet in general was something that was really, really great, because one of the things that I also did in college was create a site called IncrediCampus.com. It was essentially my final year project, but it was even before this. So what I did was essentially make a small search engine for academic content. One of the ways in which the Opera Indian people sort of like got to know me was using this. You know, they saw this website as well. And one of the people sort of like reached out, and that's how I got to know about the first sort of like event that the Opera India team was doing, and sort of like attended that, and they got to know my face and everything else. So it's some random things like these. You do something on your own because you love something, and then people discover it, and sort of you make connections. So those are things which over time make a big difference.
I actually completely agree with you. And by the way, so beautifully sort of articulated in terms of, you know, the education system and how it's designed to create more cogs versus having innovative thinking. And a sign of intelligence is not your ability to memorize stuff. And it's actually the goal of education should be to teach people not what to think, but how to think and be curious and inquisitive, ask questions. I feel the same way about education that you do. And and then I think the aspect that a lot of people miss, especially people who are trying to get hired and especially freshmen, and I think something that you did really well was that you actually demonstrated your value even before they hired you. So even though the position didn't exist, they created that position because companies are always looking for smart and intelligent people.
Good company.
So beautifully said, man. Fuck. Like, I'm so glad that I helped you out on that bus that day.
Yeah. Do you remember teachers saying that, hey, you won't have a calculator with you all the time? and now we have like mini supercomputers all the time in our pocket.
The irony of that statement.
Don't use a calculator. You won't have a calculator in your life.
And I think one thing that I sort of saw from afar, because I've been sort of following your journey silently from like sort of far away, although like, you know, we don't speak so regularly, but I've always been a fan. And I saw that one thing was that when we were in school, and because I knew the before, is that we were both sort of shy. And we didn't have like these loud attributes. But what I noticed was that once you got into opera, that you became like this public speaker. Mm-hmm. And obviously because you're an evangelist. So I would love for you to like talk a little bit about, you know, what sort of things that you learned and experienced and how you sort of overcame some of those things during that period.
Yeah, what I realized was that I also thought that I was always like an introvert, and I still think I am. What I've realized is that sometimes there's some people who are introverts, but they can turn it on in certain situations. And what I found about myself was that I am an introvert, but I can turn it on when it's required. I don't, you know, like to talk and you know, be the loud person all the time, but sometimes it is required for you to do so, especially in certain, you know, professional settings. When I joined Opera for the first 6 months, I didn't do any talk. In fact, there were other people saying, hey, when are you going to do a talk? You're an evangelist. What's happening and stuff like that. I was just observing people. I was just immersing myself. I was trying to take a look at, you know, I didn't want to be a bull in a china shop and start, you know, I having no idea of how professional presentations are done in the industry. I didn't want to, you know, come in and sort of, you know, do my own thing without seeing what others are doing. So for the first 6 months, I was just taking a look at what others are doing. You know, how are they structuring their thoughts? How are they presenting? You know, how much time do, you know, events generally give speakers? You know, how much time to take for questions? How do you deal with, you know, that was a big thing. How do you deal with questions? Are people going to have like gotcha questions and stuff like that? How do we prepare for those things? What if people ask a question and you don't know the answer? How do you respond? So those are so many different things that I was nervous about as well. And I wanted to essentially observe and immerse myself and see, okay, how are other people doing it? Maybe I can, you know, learn something from others and then, you know, synthesize that with my own thoughts as well, because you want to also find your own voice. And that was one of the things that I wanted to also do in the first 6 months. I was making draft presentations and I just wasn't going and presenting, but I was, you know, having my own thoughts and structuring them myself and trying to find my own voice. If I have to present upon this topic, how would I do that? You know, and all those kind of things. So yeah, though that was the initial thing, but overall, coming back to your, you know, original point, what I found was that when it came to events, when it came to talking publicly about certain technical topics and stuff like this, I was more than happy to do so. But in a general setting, I was a little bit more reticent. So it was good because most of the time I wasn't presenting. I was actually working in, you know, some of the other non-speaking sort of activities in my job. But every once in a while, I had that itch of, okay, I've done enough of this. Now I need to present to others and sort of reach out to them, connect and all those kind of things. So I did that as well.
That's like such a contrarian sort of point of view in the sort of product and startup space. And what I mean by that is that typically a lot of this sort of general blanket startup advice is do first and think later and learn as you go. Whereas you had like a typical sort of like, not a typical, but you had like this sort of contrarian view in that context of, let me observe first. Let me understand what are the challenges and some of the potential, you know, impediments that might come in my way. Let me prepare and find my voice. Mm-hmm. Just like an athlete might prepare for a marathon. Mm-hmm. And so you sort of prepared first and then you sort of, you know, took the next step. So I actually really find that really fascinating. In fact, I feel like that should be the norm, that you should prepare, do the study, do the research, and then sort of make that first attempt. Do you want to expand on that a little bit more? Or
yeah, I mean, there are two thoughts. One is, if you remember, like Dave Chappelle, that he started really, really early. But when he was talking about his journey, he also mentioned that for the first year or so, he was just attending, you know, comedy clubs. He wasn't going on. He was just taking a look at, you know, different comics, how, you know, different kinds of comics, what is the joke structure about? What are the things that people laugh at? What are the things that people don't laugh at? How are people killing? How are people bombing? And then afterwards, he came up on set and he killed from the first time onwards.
I'm so glad that you brought up that example, because first, I'm a big fan of Dave Chappelle and stand-up comedy. Like, yeah. And then two, the fact that there is so much merit in doing the homework, preparing, and then executing.
Yeah, it's just immersion, right? I mean, you just want to, without any specific agenda, sort of like immerse yourself and sort of observe, actively try to see, okay, what are the things that are working and what are the things that are not, without going for a specific goal, right? Just being a student of the craft. And then you, take the next leap. So, and this is one of those things that I also tell like upcoming, product managers, even if they're like seasoned product managers who are entering a new job, like a new company, don't start making decisions from day one, right? Observe in the first 30 days, don't start to ruffle the feathers. Just try to see, just try to find your way around the team, try to develop rapport, try to see how things are done currently, try to understand the strategy and where people are coming from. Instead of just coming in once again as a bull in a china shop, you should not do that. So that's one of the pieces of advice that I give a lot of people as well, especially the younger people who are a little bit more eager to make their mark. And sometimes it may not be the best way to go about things. So yeah, if doing a little bit of that homework, immersing yourself, and then taking a look towards action would be something that I generally recommend.
I totally agree with that point. I think that not only applies to like product managers, but even as like a creative leader or, sales leader, whatever that, position is, especially if it's a senior position and you're leading a team and you get brought into or dropped into a new team or new setting, is go first and observe what's happening. Look at the data. How are they performing? Talk to the people. What are their challenges before jumping into solving those problems? So it's like I'm saying you're trying to solve a problem that doesn't even exist, which brings me to the next question. What is actually I'm still like sort of so removed from all of this, but what does an actual web evangelist do? Because for me, it just looks like somebody who's like a public speaker who just travels the world. But what do they actually, what's like the actual benefit or the outcome for the business of having an evangelist like Opera, for example?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'll preface this with saying that different companies have sort of different lenses through which they see this role, but essentially a developer relations guy or girl would be taking a look at you. First of all, that company would be having some kind of technical product to offer so that, and they would want to reach out to developers in some way or the other, right? So when we're talking about technical evangelism or developer relations or developer advocate, how do we say, however you say this, you're essentially having a product where developers are working or using your platform to do something, right? And what you want to do is to make sure that they know the best ways to use your technical offerings to their best advantage, right? Now with Opera, it was a very peculiar case. Opera was one of the most standards compliant browsers ever. But the problem was it was too standards compliant sometimes. So during those times, if you remember, that was a time when we had Internet Explorer, and Firefox was, coming up and all those kind of things, which often meant that Opera was either not compatible because they were sort of optimized, including some of the bugs were optimized for those browsers. And our job was to take a look at many of these websites and contact them and say, hey, if you just change a few of these things, then it's also going to work in Opera, please do that. So a lot of that work was actually reaching out to, big websites, small websites, and sort of convincing them to change their websites that, it's browsable on Opera. So that was a major strategic thing for us to do. And the other thing was that Opera as a browser, as with other browsers during that time, if you have heard of HTML5, that was the big thing which was blowing up. And what we wanted to do was to make sure that other developers sort of understood the value of HTML5 so that they develop websites more than just applications. So we wanted to make sure that the web as a platform is something that developers make their properties available on, instead of just only making mobile apps and desktop apps. Because if that happens, then everything is siloed. You know, the web is the one thing which is sort of like accessible no matter what the platform is, whether you're on desktop, whether you're on iOS, whether you're on Android, you can always access a website. You know, so it's always universally available. And we wanted to make sure that with HTML5 coming up, we give developers all the information we needed, they needed to actually develop for the web, which would not directly help Opera, but indirectly will help Opera as well. So that was the idea behind a lot of the stuff that we did in the developer relations team in Opera during that time.
In some cases, from what I've sort of took away from this, is you're not even getting anything back. You're sort of just uplifting the overall ecosystem, helping people, building the relationships. And I think there's so many things there that salespeople can take away in terms of how they approach potential clients in their efforts when it comes to like reaching out on LinkedIn or sending cold emails, and really thinking about what is the underlying message. Are they just reaching out with the lens of like, I want something, or genuinely helping and trying to find the real problem to be solved?
It had a lot of mistakes as well. Like initially I used to reach out to people. You needed to find the right people to reach out to, first of all, especially on LinkedIn and stuff like this. And usually, you know, initially I started out with my messaging was, hey, if you change this piece of JavaScript code from this to this, then it's going to work. And obviously later on, I found out that, okay, this is something that a hacker might say. And many people were sort of like thinking that I was at some kind of like social engineer or doing some kind of hacking or something. And I very quickly sort of learned to change my messaging so that I don't immediately go towards the JavaScript code in the first message itself. You know, that can wait. First, let me just establish who I am and, you know, my credibility and everything else. And then I can sort of say, hey, by the way, it's just an easy fix. If you can just do this, then it's going to work in Opera. So that was interesting. And yeah, there was this one big website as well, I remember, which I won't name right now, but it was the biggest reported website which wasn't working for Opera in India.
Rhymes with.
Well, it's an acronym, so I don't know. but they have a huge, huge office. It's a financial institution, and it has a huge office in Mumbai. Okay. And I was going there for a conference. So I was like, okay, I'm already in Mumbai. Maybe let me just contact them and see if they're willing to have a chat. I can physically go there and see and talk to them. I somehow reached them and went through many different layers of security to eventually talk to them. And over there, I said, okay, if you just change these things to this, then it's going to work. And they said, okay, can you show us? And at that time, the security was such that I didn't even in that room have an active internet connection. So I had to, what they did was they printed out the source code of the website and they gave it to me on paper. And then I had to use a pencil to mark out the pieces of code that they needed to change on paper and give it to them. And then they did that and they fixed it. So that was one of the, you know, the biggest wins that I remember, which was how I did
it. You know, that earlier example that you gave me the story that you were saying about just sending somebody that, oh, here's the code that you need to put in. It's like saying, hey, you've won the lottery. Just click this link to get to.
I mean, now I know how ridiculous that seems. But at that time, I was like, okay, I'm saving them, you know, multiple like back and forth. I can just tell them what the issue is. Yeah. But that's not how human beings work. They are instantly suspicious of people who they don't have any idea of, who are asking a significant change in their website. So of course they have reason to be suspicious. So
that was the lesson. So the takeaway is that you know, when you're reaching out to somebody cold, you want to first just say hi, you know, and focus on building that relationship and then talking about, you know, what it is that you have to offer.
For me, it was establishing first that I was from the real opera. It wasn't someone impersonating, you know. That was one of the main things that I found people had a concern about that. And over time, that was one of the reasons why it was also good to talk in public and have that record, that if people search for me, they found not just this one entry, but multiple different YouTube videos and all those kind of things. So that was nice for people to Google you and say that, okay, you are
right.
You say you are, first of all. And then, you know, going into, you know, some of the other details that you want to go into.
So my sort of takeaway is that sort of the evangelist role is something that sales can learn a lot from, because you're out there building relationships and offering value, and in some cases, not even expecting anything in return. Because I don't even think like there's any transactional element to an evangelist role, because you're not out there trying to sell opera. You're just trying to help people have a better experience of using that product.
Yeah. And one of the things which, I mean, I didn't do that as much because my role was a little bit more focused on raising everyone, you know, lifting all ships. But one of the things that I did get better at was qualification. So, you know, you have a bunch of leads and you want to qualify which are the qualified leads. That's a pretty typical thing that you do in sales. And those are things that I had to sort of do as well when it came to reaching out to who are the decision makers who, you know, who could make sense to talk to. You know, you don't want to talk to a person in, say, marketing who has no idea of how to change or make changes in the website, for example, right? So you would want to know who are the people to talk to who can make an impact that you would want, right? So how do you correctly qualify by whatever, you know, criteria that you have? I learned how to do that. I didn't focus too much on it because my role didn't require me to focus too much on it. But of course, salespeople, I think, would require that in a much more sharper capacity, I guess.
That's so spot on. It's like you're trying to optimize and be efficient in terms of this is the person I need to talk to, and then really just focusing on that. And the ability to identify who that person is obviously comes with experience and, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. But you're right. There's definitely a lot of parallels in what an evangelist does. And in terms of like the whole outbound, like, you know, sending that cold email, who to send the cold email to and what problem might they have. And then that whole cycle of like, you know, building that relationship. And then, but there's the beauty of this is that it's not transaction driven. It's more about the overarching outcomes for not only opera itself in that case, but also the ecosystem. That sets the right philosophy and mindset. And then you come off more genuine, I guess.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so after the evangelist role, what happened next?
Even when I was just doing only and lonely developer relations work, I was, at that time, Opera also launched and then relaunched its extensions platform. And extensions was something that I, from day one, was really, really interested and fascinated with. You know, other browsers, I think Firefox for a long time at least had extensions, and I at that time, I was quite frustrated with the fact that Opera at that time didn't have extensions. And once we actually released the extensions platform, I was one of the people who was evangelizing the platform and reaching out to extensions developers saying, hey, this is how you make extensions for Opera and stuff like that. I wasn't the PM for the extensions platform at that time, but my manager at that time was. Then afterwards, when he sort of got other responsibilities, he had to take a call on, you know, whether to continue with this team as well or not. And then, you know, it was just too much for him. So there was an opening suddenly, you know, on who to do that. And then I sort of threw my hat in, sort of saying, hey, I've already, you know, working on extensions for a long time. I was working on extensions documentation and all those kind of things. So they took a chance on me and gave me, you know, the chance to become the PM for the extensions team, or the extensions platform. And that was quite fascinating as well, because what I realized was that it's really, really complicated. Even the whole extensions platform, there's, you know, entire companies out there, which, you know, are formed on the basis of browser extensions, right? And one of them I ended up working for afterwards. You know, there's an enormous amount of, you know, malware and fraud that people need to be protected from. There's just so much, you know, going on in the world of browser extensions, right from the developer experience to how end users experience this, you know. And it was just, once again, I had to reach out to new extensions developers to submit their extensions to the Opera add-on store as well, because the big daddy is the Chrome Web Store. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that it's not just, extensions are not just available over there, but also in our own, you know, web store as well. So once again, I sort of used some of the experience that I had contacting other people with the same approach of sort of submitting it to the Opera add-on store as well. So yeah, that was quite fascinating to work on as well. That was my first stint as a product manager as well. One of the things that I reflect back on at that time was, yeah, I mean, I didn't think I had that much of experience. I didn't have mentorship. I didn't have anything to go by. So it was just me flailing my arms around, sort of like trying to make sense of things. And that was in many ways a very formative experience later down in the road as well. Because whenever I now, you know, look at product management, I want to help that guy out who was, you know, 7-8 years ago, you know, who didn't have that experience, and he or she was looking for, you know, mentorship and guidance and didn't have any. And there's a lot of people out there even right now.
So out of all the things that you said, there's sort of two things I want to sort of highlight. One is, I don't think people understand how big extensions are. Like, for example, like Grammarly is literally started as an extension and it's worth over $1 billion. I don't know if you want to expand on that a little bit of like how big that extension market is.
I mean, I ended up working for a company called IO, which is famous for AdBlock Plus, which is essentially, you know, it for multiple platforms, not all, but many of these platforms is the largest extension out there. And yeah, it's enough to power the salaries of many, many, you know, hundreds of people. It's huge. Like there's entire companies, you know, being built around this. And this is also a bit scary because, you know, browser platforms can change just a few APIs, you know, in their browsers, and that could result in a massive change in the extension itself. You can literally wipe out companies just by changing a few APIs in your browser.
The big daddy is obviously Chrome, and then you have maybe like 5% of Safari, and like there's Brave and Mozilla and whatever not. But you're right, like you're literally at the mercy of those browsers.
But it's not just about browsers, though. If you also take a look at just general operating systems, you'll find, you know, a lot of like I remember just the recent Apple presentation that was there. There were about 3 or 4 different companies which are going to be really affected by some of the new features coming up in, you know, either iOS or Mac. There's a term called ShareLocked, which is there, which is specifically about Apple killing a product because they've now integrated that into their you know, their operating system. Those are things which happen all the time, and you just have to find out new ways to be relevant sometimes. And that is a big issue even right now, right? You have to, whenever you're 100% dependent on one platform, you know, that is a risk strategically.
That also is how a client and agency relationship has evolved as well, because a lot of clients will hire like a marketing agency or a design firm, and over a period of time, they'll want to develop that skill in-house. Mm-hmm. And so they'll start off with an external arm and then slowly and slowly start hiring people internally and then fire the agency. So it's not just reflective in this sort of product space, but also in the service space where, you know, eventually like larger clients will just have their own in-house product design or marketing, marcom, you know, department.
Yeah. I mean, it also makes sense a lot of times as well. If you have something which is becoming a little bit more core to your offering, why would you want to, you know, do that, you know, externally? You would want to eventually want to bring that internally as well. The challenge becomes if you mistakenly think that you can do that internally. And what happens is a lot of times the externals have a lot of experience going into what they're doing, right? Either you bring them up, you know, and they might be expensive to get sort of acquired by your company, or you sort of like take a chance and groom people internally. And sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't.
If I was to tell you, there's big banks here, and what they do is because they have deep pockets, they're able to just pluck the senior most people from those agencies and just bring them in-house and then have them develop that in-house sort of department or pod or sort of however they sort of structure it internally. So there's actually two parts to it. One is what you said is that, you know, it's not necessarily that just by hiring a few people that they can have that ability and skill set, because sometimes you do need an outside person outside of that politics and culture to be able to come in with that fresh perspective and like outside of that red tape. But at the same time, with clients with deep pockets, they have the ability to bring people in-house. But that would also mean that they are now being brought into that red tape, into that politics, where necessarily innovation and growth might not be able to flourish. So I totally agree with your point there in terms of bringing that skill set in-house versus being an external arm, and how the advantages of being external versus sort of internal.
And this is where distribution comes in, because even if you have an inferior product, if you have better distribution, you can win, and you often do win.
Do you want to expand on that? Like any example or something?
I won't want to pick one particular example, but there's been many, many new product features, you know, whether you take a look at operating systems or whether you take a look at others, where there have been external companies which are doing the same thing and they're really, really good. But at, you know, just because you can have network effects with an already big product, even if you don't have the best one right now, over time you can, you know, increase your user base. Like, for example, let's take a look at Slack and Microsoft Teams, right? Most people that I talk to are, if they have to choose between those two, they would choose Slack. But since Microsoft Teams is really embedded into the actual, you know, system,
you're touching a nerve. You know?
And over time, they can make it better and better and better. Like,
yeah.
Even when it comes to Xbox versus PlayStation, you know, the first one or two iterations of Xbox, you know, weren't touching, you know, Sony. Over time, they became better, 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 and became, you know, on the same level, and sometimes even better than Sony. Now, I am a Sony fanboy in terms of gaming, so it, to me, it's heresy. But over time, if you can latch on to good distribution, you can iterate towards a better product. Whereas if you don't have that distribution, you have to be innovative. You have to do, you know, 10 times better than the competition, because you don't have that distribution to latch on to. This is where distribution becomes a superpower. If you can sort of attach that to already a huge user base somehow, your product doesn't necessarily need to be the best right from the gate, right? Over time, you can improve and improve and get there. The main thing is, you know, getting more and more users using the distribution you already have. So that is a massive advantage.
So many great things that you just said. One, and some examples that sort of come to my mind, I think first is sort of what is that org incentive structure sort of set up, and how sort of leadership is embedded. Like, for example, like for a large corporate, like Microsoft 365 would be probably like a sort of a procurement purchase. And then they probably have like their own cyber, like security issues and regulation and all that stuff. And so they have to work within that ecosystem. So they're going to intrinsically force teams down everybody's throat. Mm-hmm. I mean, to use very harsh language. So even though there might be a better product out there, you know, for example, you know, this is a conflict that always happens in terms of like, should we use Dropbox? Should we use Slack? So I think that outcome hierarchy that's happening in terms of, you know, procurement made decision versus what is the best product. But then I think to your point, because Microsoft now got the product in front of so many hands, they've been able to iterate and improve it. And it is pretty good, actually. To be honest, I don't want to shit on Microsoft Teams. I mean, it's no Slack, but it's pretty cool in terms of the innovations they've done and how they've listened to user feedback. So there is merit to it, but also it's like sometimes why that is happening. Sometimes we don't even know, because it's that decision was made not even necessarily by your boss, but like by the procurement team, who's not even necessarily communicating with the people who are actually going to be using that thing.
That's one of the things which is fascinating about the current state of especially B2B products, where, you know, usually speaking, at least till, you know, a few years ago, the only way in which truly successful B2B products used to work was a sales-led model, where you had a sales team, you talk with big enterprises and sort of convinced the buyer. And once again, the buyer is different than the user a lot of times, right? The guy who's or girl who's making the procurement decision is different than the person who would be using that day to day. And a lot of like shitty enterprise software that you see is so because most of the most of the efforts are going towards getting a yes from the buyer. And what's happening or what's fascinating nowadays is the whole product-led growth or PLG, you know, way of thinking, which is having more of a bottoms-up approach where you, like Slack, once again, let's take a look at that. I mean, you know, there wasn't a massive sales team in the beginning, you know, banging on the door of enterprises saying, hey, have Slack. It was essentially a bottoms up thing where the product was so good that everyone started using Slack. And then eventually it became so much that many people convinced their organizations to use Slack organization wide, right? And so on and so forth. The product-led growth, you know, strategy right now is something which I think is going to be used much more in B2B, you know, products going forward. That doesn't mean that salespeople are totally, you know, diminished. There's going to be a role for them as well. But more and more, you know, we are seeing in B2B products, you know, the whole trend of product-led growth, and I think it's going to become more and more, you know, prevalent in many of these different products as well.
I was listening to another podcast like a couple of days ago, and there's this cartoonist, a Wall Street Journal cartoonist. His name is Stu, and he sort of describes this as like the weed strategy. You know how like weed is so resilient and it can sort of grow anywhere. Mm-hmm. And once it gets to a certain point, you know, the leadership has to take notice and be like, you know what, all our people are using this thing now, you know, either we can kill it, you know, use pesticides, or, you know, encourage it and let, you know, people sort of use what they like. And in fact, it actually works really well in a lot of different cases. But sometimes what happens is that, let's say, for example, in a manufacturing situation, the factory manager and the people working on the machines and stuff, they have a very different interpretation experience in terms of what they need to do and how to be efficient. And necessarily the executives who are sitting hundreds of miles away don't even have a sense of like, there's no connection between those. So I think that to go and speak to the person with the pain, giving them that access and then letting that sort of percolate upwards to what you're saying, that makes actually a lot of sense. I think the fact that the buyer is not necessarily the user, the consumer is not the customer. You articulated that so beautifully.
There's also one more thing, which is like the inversion of the typical model in such a case. In a sales head model, usually it's like, okay, should we adopt this inside the organization or not? That is the question, right? And then you have different factors, negotiation, all those kind of things. In a product-led growth model, if it is successful, the idea isn't should we adopt this? People are already using it, so it becomes, should we ban this and use something else? or so, you know, that's a, that's sort of an inversion of the typical model that you have in such cases. And sometimes it might make sense, and sometimes it's just too late. Everyone is already using, you know, this particular piece of software. And you can sort of make a very unpopular decision of going with something else, or you can just, you know, go with the flow and already have a bunch of, you know, work happening in that thing.
Would this be a correct assessment and sort of that it's a, the most democratic way, and you're giving by each user, you're creating one voting share. So that decision, when it's made, you have all the votes, and it's a complete democracy of what tool is going to be used and what, and that could be applied to, like, you know, what kind of policies and, you know, work culture and how that works comes from the bottom up.
It really depends upon the organization as well. There are some organizations which are extremely strict with their, you know, security and privacy policies. And there's some things which, you know, for some reason, like, for example, GDPR, you would want to make sure that you exclude some.
What
some
is GDPR, by the way, for people listening? And even I don't know what that is, by the way.
Well, it's complicated, but it's a European sort of it's a law from the European Union. Having some restrictions or certain directives on how you would use user data and how would you have focused software, you could say. As part of it, a lot of times, especially in European organizations, you might have that, okay, user data needs to be needs to be stored on, you know, European servers or servers located in Europe, for example. Not all organizations take that such a call, but many of them do. Things like these can really make sense to consider as well. So a lot of times you might have a successful sort of product-led growth sort of like situation inside a company, and then it becomes big enough, and then the IT team comes in and says, hey, you cannot use this because it violates this thing. Well, those things can happen, right? But those things can also happen in a sales-led model where you might be talking to a salesperson, and then for some reason or the other, the negotiations break down and they can say, hey, bye. So that can also happen, right? So I think the future is going to be product-led sales, where essentially have a product-led growth model coupled with smart salespeople who can accelerate this growth as well.
Three things that I learned from what you just said. One is the restrictions. And I think what you're talking about, if I've understood this correctly, is the scale of the organization. Because in my personal experience, for example, I work with closely with large consulting firm, and they have like cybersecurity as one of their sort of service offering. So they're very strict about how each device is used because there's so much confidential data, like, you know, because they're working with large banks or private and public sector. Any outside application is like a strict no. Like, you can't even download those applications on those devices. There's such a strict sort of walled garden around what employees can use. And I know this because we were trying to bring in like, and actually this is still in flight sort of, like how to bring in this virtual tools to do, you know, to show up differently in a virtual setting. So how do you bring in those tools into this large org? So that's an interesting learning for me as well, to go through that process and see how the decisions are made, what stakeholders get involved.
One of the points that you made was about, you know, these big organizations which lock down everything, right? Big enterprises generally have some restrictions, right? Whether it's, if it's a medical company, they might have things regarding HIPAA compliance and stuff like that. And your software needs to be, you know, compliant to those things. So being compliant with regulations is always going to be a big thing for massive enterprises. But small to medium businesses, even large ones, which are not playing in those spaces, that's much better, you know, ground for product-led growth.
So one was that compliance, meeting regulation, and sort of how do you penetrate that walled garden? And in those cases, I think you have to start with sort of the buyer first, but come in to that conversation, understanding what frontline, you know, or the end users of that thing, what challenges they have, and then, you know, knowing decision ladder, but also the end user, and being able to communicate that and get that conversation going. But I think in this product-led sort of growth model, I think instead of having salespeople, what you need to have is a hybrid of evangelist and sales. So you have product-led growth, but it's an evangelist meets salesperson. And now that person is coming from that right mindset, because they're not thinking transactionally, but they're thinking more ecosystem and, you know, enabling people versus I have to sell this thing and hit my targets and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's where marketing also comes in. So you have salespeople fully focused on making those sales. We have marketing, which is just generally about positioning and making sure that you just do a better job of communicating the pluses. And then yeah, you have the actual product doing a good job as well, so that the people using this are internal advocates or internal champions
right.
for this as well, right? So for sales in general, you would need some kind of champion for you inside the organization. And yeah. with good product and the product-led growth model, you can have, well, more of a chance of more internal champions for adopting that inside the organization. That doesn't mean that 100% it's going to be, the case that your product is going to be, adopted, yeah. right? There's many other things like compliance and, pricing and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
But that gives you much more of a shot.
And I would want to end on one critical question. And I think it's sort of the thread that's sort of put this whole first conversation that you and I are having. And I want to have obviously many, many more, because there's so many things I want to like do double clicks into, dive deeper into. But because you've always been the guy who's been more closer to the technology side of things and working closely with engineers, but then also you clearly have understanding of sales, marketing, and all that stuff. And then also the fact that, sort of being that introvert, shy person, and then that learning, and observing people and how they communicate. So my question here is, for upcoming people who are engineers or product people, what's the role of communication in getting to outcomes and results and growing in your career as a sort of a wrapper to the whole conversation?
One of the things that bothered me for a long time, and this was during my school and college days, and sometimes even in the beginning, first few years in my job as well, which was that I always saw myself as a jack of all trades, master of none.
By the way, I don't want to cut you, but do you know the full sentence of that? So it's jack of all trades, master of none, but better than master of one.
Yeah,
that's the full line.
I mean, that's basically what I was coming to as well, which was I saw that for the longest time as a weakness. What I realized was that this, for me at least, it was a strength that I could understand developers, I could understand product people, salespeople, marketing people. I had that ability to communicate with a bunch of them. Over time, with the Opera role and a few others, I learned how to develop expertise quickly because you had to. Like if there's a new API coming up, how would you talk to developers in a convincing way if you don't have expertise yourself, right? And it's going to be released in 2 months. You need to develop that right now. You have to. So it gave me the training to develop expertise quickly. But at the same time, since I had this base of being, a general communicator, that was good to reach out to multiple people. Also, over time, I realized was that you can make connections between those people. You can serve as a bridge between developers and sales. You can serve as a bridge between, the CEO and someone who doesn't understand product strategy at all. You can explain it in, simpler terms. So those are things, especially in product, but anywhere in general, it can be a superpower if you harness this in the best way possible. With communication, the best thing that I've done is to sort of translate things from one place to the other, right? So translate what this means in sales to what this would translate to in is part of like code, right? For example, or vice versa as well, right? Doing that translation work really is something which requires, bridging different areas, right? So that's one thing. But in general, like the role of communication is also dependent upon what you want to. Sometimes you want alignment. You want everyone to think about the same thing, right? Sometimes you want clarity. Like everyone is confused and you want to make sure that, you solve that confusion, right? Sometimes it's resolving conflict, right? You would want, like there's two people and I've had this situation where two of my reports are fighting with each other, and I have to sort of come in and make sure that, you know, so, and sometimes it's feedback. Sometimes it's, you know, as a manager, sometimes you have to give bad feedback or feedback that might pinch some others. But at the same time, you also have to give feedback which can raise morale of people and of teams as well. You have different purposes for communication, making sure that you pick the right tool to achieve that goal. Doing the translation work, being a jack of all trades, is actually a skill which, you know, is surprisingly rare. So you have to develop that as well.
Very, very beautifully said. Communication is sort of the glue that sort of brings everything together. It helps you articulate your vision, bring people together, helps build culture, and you're able to express that vision and aligns people, because ultimately, you know, a lot of times, you know, people who work very closely in tech or engineering or are working in the Web3 space, they forget that all of this is ultimately for some sort of a human at the end of that thing. And not all human beings are technical or engineers, and they just care about what they care about. If you have that scale of communication sort of cutting across all those things, that's going to help you get to those outcomes faster, help pave the path of becoming a better leader. It's a skill that a lot of people miss and forget. They just get so focused on, you know, I'm just developing this one thing. But till you bring that emotional element to it, till you build that trust and confidence in terms of like that outreach stuff that you were talking about, in the absence of emotion, logic sort of falls flat on its face.
It's also the difference a lot of times between engineers and really senior engineers. You know, a lot of times they have the same skill set. It's just the one person is better at communicating and working and collaborating with others than the other. You know, technically, they might be pretty much similar, but one is way better and way more valuable to the organization simply because of their superior communication skills and collaboration skills.
Mind blown. I'm sorry, I have like chicken skin. My biggest takeaway from this is that irrespective of, you know, you're a technology person, engineer, whatever that is, if you are a 10 on 10 on skill, but you can only communicate 2 on 10, then what do people think? Are you a 10 on 10 or 2 on 10?
Yeah, I mean, if no one wants like the brilliant jerks, you know, you would want people who are skillful, but at the same time are pleasant to work with and sort of, you know, make you better as well. So, and bring out the best in you. Those are the people that you would want to work with instead of the opposite, right? That is so underrated, but at the same time, yeah, so critical as well.
Yeah, I think that's another whole podcast episode in terms of who do you bring onto your team or into your sort of company who is going to be a good culture fit and aligns on vision and values and is maybe not necessarily about all the skills, but who is this person that I'm going to be working with side by side and I have to see their face every day? What's their temperament like and all that stuff? I think that's another topic and episode we should explore maybe in the next episode. But this was great. I really enjoyed this conversation.
All right. Well, looking forward to the next time.
Yeah, man. Same.